Lecture number 7, The Noble Eightfold Path. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Dukkha, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. These are the four noble truths, the elephant's footprint that contains within itself all the other teachings of the Buddha. It might be risky to say that any one truth is more important than the others, since they all hang together in a very close, integral unity. But if we want to single out one truth as the key to the whole Dhamma, would be the fourth noble truth, the truth of the way. The way to the end of dukkha is the Noble Eightfold Path, the path made up of right views, right intentions, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. When we say that the path is the most important element in the teaching, this is because the path is the thing that makes the Dhamma available as a living experience. Without the path, the Dhamma would just be a shell, a collection of doctrines and formulas without inner life, without the immediacy of lived experience. The path is the means to self-transformation, the means to spiritual growth, and to the attainment of liberation. Without the path, even full deliverance from suffering would just become an empty dream. Now, it should be understood that the Noble Eightfold Path was not created by the Buddha. The path is not a creation or a product of the Buddha's mind. Rather, the path was discovered by the Buddha. Whether a Buddha arises or not, the path remains as the indispensable means to enlightenment. During periods when no Buddha has appeared in the world, then the path might be shrouded in darkness, will be lost to the masses of mankind, completely forgotten. But when a Buddha arises, he does not create the path anew out of his own mind. Rather, he rediscovers the lost path to deliverance and then makes that path known again to the world. In fact, that is the special and unique function of the Buddha, is to rediscover the path during a period of spiritual darkness and then to proclaim the path to humanity at large, to make the path available to the world. And the Buddha says, with respect to the path, he says that on the night of his enlightenment, he uses the phrase, light arose, knowledge arose, vision arose. These statements all indicate that he saw what was already present, but present unseen. He tore away the veil of darkness, the veil of delusion and ignorance, and saw the lost, buried path to enlightenment. He followed that path through to its goal, reached the goal, and then taught the path to the world at large. From one angle, the discovery of the Noble Eightfold Path might be called the primary significance of the Buddha's enlightenment. Before his renunciation, when he was still living in the palace as a bodhisattva, as a prince, he had already recognized the unsatisfactory nature of existence. He had been thrust up against the hard facts of old age, sickness, and death. He had lost all of his worldly complacency, his desire for power, fame, and for sense pleasures. Then, even from the start, he had an intuition, a confidence that there was a way out of suffering, a state of liberation beyond the round of birth and death. Because of his confidence, he was able to leave the palace to renounce the world in order to go in search of deliverance. But what he did not know, what he lacked, what he had to find was the path that led to deliverance. And with the discovery of the path, he was able to escape from the trap of ignorance, to reach enlightenment, to become Buddha. The discovery of the path made it possible for him to attain his own liberation, to attain Nibbana himself. And it was also the discovery of the path that enabled him to guide others to liberation, to present others with the gift of the deathless. Therefore, the path gives the Buddha's enlightenment a meaning that goes beyond his own liberation. It makes the Buddha into a world teacher, and it makes his doctrine, his Dhamma, something relevant to all men, to all beings who seek release from suffering. The path is essentially a way to awakening, a means to generate in our own minds the same experience of enlightenment that the Buddha himself went through while sitting beneath the Bodhi tree. In the causal chain that originates dukkha, the Buddha points out that all the suffering and unsatisfactoriness we meet in the round of becoming arises because of our craving and our clinging. This craving and clinging, in turn, is nurtured by the more basic factor, that is, ignorance, the beginningless blindness to the real nature of things that has been covering over our minds. And as long as we remain in ignorance, we go on revolving in the cycle of existence, going from life to life, meeting the various forms of dukkha. In order to get free from dukkha, to get free from suffering, what is necessary is to eliminate the most fundamental root of all bondage, that is ignorance. To eliminate ignorance, what is needed is its exact opposite, knowledge, the knowledge of enlightenment, the superior wisdom that shines brightly and eclipses the darkness of ignorance. But this wisdom, this knowledge of the true nature of things, does not arise out of nothing. It arises out of conditions. The set of conditions that lead to enlightenment, these constitute a path, the Noble Eightfold Path. And the Noble Eightfold Path brings liberation by giving rise to the liberating wisdom. In describing the Buddha, the path, the Buddha says that the path produces knowledge, produces vision. Chakku Karani Jnana Karani. These two terms together, knowledge and vision, the coupling indicates that the kind of knowledge to which the path leads is not abstract conceptual knowledge, but immediate insight. The Buddha says that the path is Chakku Karani. It produces the eye. It gives us the eye of insight by which we are able to see directly with immediate perception the true nature of things. Then, by producing this knowledge and vision, the path leads to peace, upasamaya, the peace that comes with the destruction of all craving, all attachments, and all clinging. The path leads to enlightenment, the full and complete realization of truth, sambodhi. And by leading to enlightenment, it leads us out of the cycle of suffering, the round of birth and death, to the ultimate goal, the unconditioned state, nibbana, the deathless. In his first discourse, the Buddha calls the Noble Eightfold Path the middle way, Majjhima Padipadda. He calls it the middle way because the Eightfold Path avoids all extremes in conduct and in views. In the first discourse, the Buddha points out that there are two extremes which a seeker of enlightenment has to steer clear of. These two extremes are, on the one side, indulgence and desire, on the other, self-mortification. Now, some people hold the view that this life, this present life, is our only existence, that death spells the end to all experience, and therefore we should try to get as much pleasure as we can by indulging our desires. This view, they say, is the superior wisdom, and the practice of sensual indulgence, grasping comfort and luxury, they hold to be the way to the greatest happiness. But the Buddha, from his own experience, calls this way a low, inferior, ignoble course, which doesn't lead to the realization of the highest goal, the true aim of human life. The other extreme is not so common as the first, but it's always had a certain attraction for religious seekers. This is the extreme of self-mortification. Those who follow this practice hold that the way to liberation, the way to enlightenment, lies through strict and austere asceticism, especially through the practice of the mortification of the flesh. Generally, those who follow this path regard the body and the spirit as exclusive and antagonistic opposites. And they see the mind of man as a battlefield where a struggle takes place between the spirit and the flesh. The flesh they hold to be the source of evil, of desire and darkness. The spirit, the source of goodness, of light and freedom. And to liberate the spirit, they say, the flesh has to be subdued by fierce austerity, by tormenting the body, by depriving the body of its vital requisite until the spirit can be released from the prison of the body. The Buddha himself had practiced this path of asceticism before his enlightenment, but he found that it doesn't lead to the goal. Therefore, he later called the path of self-affliction painful, ignoble, and not conducive to the goal. He advised his disciples also to steer clear of it, not to follow that kind of practice. Instead, in its place, he holds up the Noble Eightfold Path as the middle way. And it's called the middle way not because it lies in between the two extremes, as a compromise between too much and too little, but rather because it rises above them, because it's free from their errors, from their imperfections, from the blind alleys to which they lead. On one side, the Noble Eightfold Path avoids the extreme of sensual indulgence. On the other, it avoids the extreme of self-affliction. To follow the middle path means to provide the body what it needs to stay in a strong and healthy condition, and yet at the same time to rise above bodily concerns, in order to train the mind in right conduct, concentration, and wisdom. In fact, the middle way is essentially a way of mind training. And one error, frequent error, has to be pointed out, and that is that the middle way is in no way a compromise with the attitude of renunciation. In following the Noble Eightfold Path, the mind has to be strengthened, trained in the strongest attitude of renunciation, detachment from the demands of craving and clinging. The middle way doesn't compromise at all the spirit of renunciation. But what it recognizes is that the real renunciation, the most important renunciation, is an inward mental act, to be achieved by training the mind, not by tormenting the body. Now, as its name suggests, the Noble Eightfold Path is made up of eight factors. And when it's called the Eightfold Path, we have to be careful not to understand this wrongly. The eight factors of the path are not eight steps to be followed in sequence. In actual practice, certain factors have to be developed before other factors can arise. But ideally, each factor that emerges does not replace the one that comes before it, nor do the earlier factors that have been developed drop away when the more advanced factors appear. Rather, the early factors remain, but the new ones that arise merge into them and absorb them, so that at its highest level of development, the path consists of eight factors working simultaneously. At this level, all eight factors are present, all are performing their functions, all are contributing in their own unique way to the accomplishment of the goal, to reaching the end of suffering. Now, the eight factors of the path can be divided into two parts. One part is concerned with knowledge, with understanding. The other is concerned with practice or conduct. Now, the first part, the side concerned with understanding, contains only one factor, right view. The other part, the part concerned with practice, contains the other seven factors, from right intention through right concentration. And so from this twofold division, we can see the tremendous weight that falls on right view. Right view is placed first, right at the beginning of the path, because right view is the eye which guides and directs all the other factors. The relationship between the two groups of path factors can be illustrated by an analogy. If we're going to drive a car, we need both our eyes and our limbs. We need eyes to see which way to go, and we need our limbs, the hands and feet, in order to maneuver the car. If we have eyes, but if we're crippled and can't use our hands and feet, then we can't move the car at all. We'll just remain in the same spot. And if we can use our limbs, but if we lack sight, if we're blind, then it would be dangerous even to try to drive. To maneuver the car and get to our destination, we need both the eyes and the limbs working in harmony. Similarly, in the practice of the path, we need both aspects, the aspect of vision or understanding supplied by right view, in order to see the way to travel along the path. Then we need the other factors, conduct or practice, in order to bring us to our destination. Now, the Buddha places right view at the beginning of the path to show that before we can set put on the actual practice, we need the understanding provided by right view as our guide, our inner director, to show us where we're starting from, where we're heading, and what are the successive stages to be passed through in practice. Usually, the Buddha defines right view as the understanding of the Four Noble Truths: suffering, its origin, its cessation, and the way to its cessation. To follow the path right from the start, we need a correct perspective on the human condition. We have to see that our lives are not fully satisfactory, that life is impermanent, that it's subject to suffering. And we have to understand that suffering, dukkha, is something that we have to penetrate through to by means of knowledge, something that we have to conquer, not something that we should escape from by pain removers, entertainments, distractions, or dull forgetfulness. At the deepest level, we have to see that all the things that make up our being, the five aggregates, are impermanent, constantly changing, and therefore can't be held to as a basis for security or unchanging happiness. then we have to see that the cause of our dukkha lies in our own mind. Nobody is imposing it on us. We can't put the blame outside ourselves. It's through our own craving and clinging, our desires, our dislikes, and our delusions, that we produce suffering and pain for ourselves. Then, when we see that the cause of dukkha lies in our mind, we also understand that the key to liberation also lies in the mind, by overcoming ignorance and craving by means of wisdom. Then, to enter the path, we need the confidence that by following the Noble Eightfold Path, we can reach the goal, the cessation of suffering. The Buddha defines right view as the understanding of the Four Noble Truths for a very important reason. The reason is that he does not want his disciples to practice his teaching merely out of feelings of devotion towards him or out of respect for his wisdom. Rather, he wants them to follow the path on the basis of their own understanding, their own insight into the nature of human life. Therefore, the first factor sets out the points to be grasped, the points to be seen as a basis for practice. Then, when we've grasped these essential truths and verified them through thought and reflection, then we're ready to set foot on the path with a clear idea of the real aim and groundwork to the practice. Otherwise, to try to practice the path without having this right view is somewhat like just getting into a car and driving in any direction, without having a clear idea of where we want to get to and what is the best way to get there. As we will see later, the path begins only with a very elementary level of right understanding. As the mind develops in the course of practice, the understanding will deepen, will gradually expand and widen. And as it does so, we come back again and again to right view. Right view is not something that we just go through only once and then leave it aside. But again and again, we always come back to right view. But when we come back at deeper and deeper levels of understanding. Through practice, the consciousness, the mind, is developed. Its range and capacity for comprehension expands, grows, and matures. Then as it matures, the ability to see, to penetrate and understand develops. And when we understand, then we arrive at a deeper level of right view. The second factor of the path is right intention, sama sankappa. The word sankappa means purpose, intention, resolve, aspiration, motivation. And this factor of right intention follows as the natural consequence of right view. When, through right view, we gain an understanding of the real nature of existence, then that understanding acts upon our mind. It changes our motivation, our purposes in life, our intentions and inclinations. Then, as a result, our minds become shaped by right intentions, intentions that accord with right view and that follow from right view. In the analysis of this factor, the Buddha explains that there are three kinds of right intentions: the intention of renunciation, the intention of non-aversion or loving-kindness, and the intention of non-injury or compassion. And these are opposed respectively to the three wrong intentions: the intention of sensuality, the intention of aversion, and the intention of harmfulness or cruelty. Now, right intention, as we said, follows naturally from right view. When we gain a right view into the fact of dukkha, Then we become motivated to renounce our attachments, our clinging to pleasure, wealth, power, and fame. These we usually imagine to be desirable, but we take them to be desirable only because we haven't seen their inherent unsatisfactoriness. When we see that they lead to dukkha, that they lead us into suffering and dissatisfaction, then our mind inclines to renounce them, to give them up. We don't have to force ourselves away from their desire, from the desire for them. But as we gain the understanding, the right view, the desire falls off naturally by itself. Then when we look at other beings through the lens of the Four Noble Truths, we see that others are also caught up in the nest of suffering. And out of this perception, there arises a feeling of deep identification with others, feeling of oneness with them, which leads to attitudes of loving kindness and compassion. And as these attitudes arise, they motivate us to renounce, to give up all aversion and hatred and all violence and cruelty. In this way, the three types of right intentions follow from right view. Now, the first two factors of the path, right view and right intentions, work together in opposition to the three unwholesome roots. In earlier talks, we explained that the three unwholesome roots are greed, hatred, and delusion. Of these, the most fundamental is delusion. Out of delusion, there arise greed and hatred, the one desiring, the other disliking the wrongly conceived object. Now, right view serves to counteract delusion. Delusion is non-understanding, non-comprehension. And right view gives us correct understanding. It leads to true comprehension. Then, the second factor, right intention, counteracts greed and hatred. The intention of renunciation opposes greed. The other two intentions of non-aversion and non-injury counteract hatred. Thus, already at the very beginning of the path, the process is set in motion that will eventually cut off all three unwholesome roots. With the next three factors, we learn to translate right intentions into right conduct. We apply the right intentions to our bodily and verbal deeds, to our general way of life. And thus we get the three factors of right speech, right action, and right livelihood. Right speech has four aspects. Abstaining from false speech, that is, from lying. Instead, making an effort always to speak truthfully. Second, abstaining from slanderous speech, from statements intended to divide others, to create enmity between other people. Instead, the follower of the path should always speak words that promote friendship and harmony between people. Then thirdly, he should abstain from harsh speech, from speech which is angry and bitter, which cuts into the hearts of others. Instead, his speech should always be gentle, soft, and affectionate. And then fourthly, he abstains from idle chatter, from gossip. Instead, he should always speak words that are meaningful, significant, and purposeful. The fact that four factors are mentioned under right speech shows the tremendous power locked up in the faculty of speech. The tongue might be a very small organ compared to the rest of the body, but this little organ can create immense harm or immense good, depending on how it's used. Therefore, in order to gain mastery over our life, we have to master that little organ, the tongue, to see that it's used only for good purposes, not for bad ones. Of course, what we really have to master is not the tongue, but the mind that makes use of the tongue. Now, right action, the fourth factor of the path, is concerned with bodily action, with the body as an instrument of action. And this has three aspects: abstaining from the destruction of life, that is, from killing other living beings. And this applies not only to human beings, but to animals as well, to abstain from hunting, fishing, needless killing of animals. And second, to abstain from taking what is not given, that is, from stealing, cheating, exploiting others, gaining wealth in dishonest or illegal ways. And thirdly, to abstain from sexual misconduct, that is, from illicit types of sexual relations, such as adultery, seduction, rape, and so on. Generally, the lay follower of the path is advised to avoid adultery or any type of forced sexual relations, while those who become ordained into the Sangha as monks and nuns have to observe the precept of celibacy. And it's very frequent also in the Buddhist tradition for lay practitioners who are undergoing a period of intensive training and meditation to take temporarily the precepts of celibacy. Now, the principles of right speech and right action are worded negatively as abstaining from this and that, but a little reflection would show that positive psychological factors of great power go along with these abstinences. The abstinences are required as the minimal observance, and it is that which comes directly under the control of the faculties of speech and bodily action. But while these outward principles of abstinence are being observed, at the same time, wholesome attitudes of mind are also being cultivated. And that is how the observance of the principles of abstinence brings about a gradual purification of the mind. The observance of each one of these precepts implies a commitment to some positive mental quality, to a virtue, a habit of the practical intellect. That is, abstaining from taking of life, for example, implies a commitment to compassion, for respecting the rights of other beings to life. The precept of abstaining from stealing, taking what is not given, involves a commitment to honesty, to being honest in one's relations with others, and also a commitment to respect the right of others to the possession of their own belongings. The principle of abstaining from false speech implies a commitment to truth, to maintain the truth, no matter how difficult it might be to ourselves. And so on, for each one of these negatively worded abstinences, if we reflect, we can find a positive virtue in the mind that has to be cultivated simultaneously. Now, the fifth factor of the path is right livelihood. The Buddha teaches that the disciple should avoid any occupation or job that causes harm and suffering to other living beings, or any kind of work that leads to one's own inner deterioration. Instead, the disciple should earn his or her living in an honest, harmless, and peaceful way. And to give a more specific idea of what right livelihood involves, the Buddha mentions five occupations that a disciple should avoid. These are, first, dealing in flesh, in meat, as a butcher. Second, dealing in poison. Third, dealing in weapons or arms. Fourth, dealing in slave trade and prostitution. And fifth, dealing in intoxicants and liquors and drugs. And the Buddha also says that his followers should avoid deceitfulness, hypocrisy, high-pressure salesmanship, usury, and trickery, or any kind of dishonest method in acquiring their means of support. Now, these three factors that we've just discussed, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, these deal with the outer conduct of life. When we come to the next three factors, the sixth, seventh, and eighth factors, then we're concerned with the inner work, with the training of the mind. The Buddha begins the mind training with right effort, samavayama. This factor the Buddha places a special stress on for the reason that the practice of the path requires work. It calls for energy and exertion. The Buddha is not a savior. The means to deliverance he gives in the path. Now we can't expect to get anywhere along the path without making the effort. The Buddha says that the Tathagatas, the enlightened ones, point out the path. You yourselves must make the effort. The goal, the Buddha says, is for the energetic person, not for the lazy one. And here we come to the great optimism of Buddhism, the optimism which, in my view, refutes all the charges of pessimism. The Buddha says that through right effort, through right exertion, through the right application of energy, it's possible to change and transform the whole structure of our lives. We're not the hopeless victim of our past conditioning. We're not the victim of our genes, of environment, of our upbringing, and so on. But through training, through practice and exercise, it's possible to raise the mind up to entirely new levels, to lift it up from the swamp of ignorance and self-centered desire, to bring it to the high plateaus of wisdom, enlightenment, and liberation. It all takes work. All it takes is exercise and effort. Practice that has to be built up day by day, month by month, year by year, even lifetime by lifetime. So with this practice, we can lift the mind up to the highest levels of spiritual attainment. And therefore, the Buddha urges his disciples to strive on with the firm determination. Whatever has not been attained, that I will attain. What hasn't been achieved, that I will achieve. What hasn't been realized, that I will realize. Then, having stirred up the will, we have to know the right way to apply our efforts. Now, the Buddha indicates that right efforts can be broken down into four aspects. Firstly, if we observe the states that arise in the mind, we see that they fall into two basic types: unwholesome states and wholesome states. The unwholesome states are the states of mind rooted in the defilement, in greed, hatred, delusion, and in their offshoots. The wholesome side consists of the virtuous qualities, the qualities that should be developed and cultivated, like the eight factors of the Noble Path, the four foundations of mindfulness, the seven factors of enlightenment, and so on. These are the pure, noble qualities that lead to spiritual progress and to ultimate liberation. Thus, we have at the opposite sides of the mind the unwholesome states and the wholesome ones. And with regard to each of these, there are two tasks we have to perform. First, with regard to the unwholesome side, we have to make the effort to prevent the unarisen, unwholesome states from arising. The unwholesome states are not always present in the mind. At times, the mind is clear, calm, and pure. Then something happens which sparks off one of the defilements. Now, in developing right effort, in the first place, we have to make the effort to prevent the unarisen defilements from arising. This is the first aspect of right effort, called the effort to prevent. And this is accomplished primarily by control over the senses. If we lack control over the senses, then the mind responds automatically to the sense objects that it meets. It gives way to attachment to pleasant objects. It gives way to aversion and anger towards unpleasant ones. But by maintaining watchfulness over the senses, by watching our reactions to the sense objects, then we can prevent the unarisen defilements from arising. We're able to simply register the object, to take note of its features without being drawn to react to the object by way of greed and aversion. The second aspect of right effort is the effort to abandon the arisen unwholesome state. That is, to eliminate the defilements that have arisen. When we see in our mind that one of these unwholesome states is present, we have to apply our energy to eliminate it. This can be done by a variety of methods. In one sutta, the Buddha gives 5 different methods for training the mind to overcome unwholesome states. One method is to replace the unwholesome thought formation by its opposite, by the wholesome thought exactly opposed to it. For example, if strong attachment arises in the mind to, say, wealth or possessions, then we can reflect on the impermanence of those possessions. When we do that, the attachment fades away. If strong sensual desire arises in the mind, especially for a monk or a nun or a meditating yogi, then if he reflects on the impure nature of the body, how the body is just a heap of skin, bones, organs, and blood, then the sense desire fades away. When anger and ill will towards a person arise in the mind, then by reflecting or meditating on loving kindness, the feeling of loving kindness will dispel the anger. Or if the state of depression, dejection arises in the mind, then reflecting on the noble qualities of the Buddha gives a kind of joy and encouragement which inspires us to make further effort. So in that way, we use one thought, a wholesome thought, to knock out the unwholesome thought. In the same way that, for example, a carpenter might use a clean new peg to knock out an old rotten peg from a board of wood. A second method to use is to develop a keen sense of the danger in the unwholesome thoughts, to recognize how they keep us entangled in suffering and prevent us from accomplishing the real good for ourselves and for others. Still, another method is to turn the mind away from the objects that are stimulating the unwholesome thoughts, to divert the mind to some other object of concentration. For example, perhaps just to the breathing or to the movement of some part of the body. A fourth method is simply to observe the thoughts themselves, to turn the attention upon the thoughts, to see how they arise, then gradually to still them, to make them quiet down. This can be done also by tracing the causes of the thoughts in sequence. Saying that thought arises from this cause, that cause from this cause, and so on, back in sequence. This makes the disturbing thoughts quiet down. Then, when all of these other techniques fail, and only then, the last measure which can be used is to meet the unwholesome thought in face-to-face combat, to struggle with it, and to expel it from the mind. But this should be used only as the last measure. Okay, now we come to the other side, the third and fourth aspects of right effort. On the other side of the mind, we find that there are many pure, wholesome, virtuous states of mind. And for these two, there are two tasks to be performed. First, we have to make the effort to develop the undeveloped wholesome state. We have many beautiful potentials stored up in the mind. We have to bring these up to the surface of the mind, to develop them, strengthen them, to make them shine forth. Then, when we've cultivated them, then we come to the